Welcome to the Sumner Church of Christ. All right, so open your Bibles up to John chapter 13, please. And in John chapter 13, it reads, "If I then, the Lord and teacher, wash your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also ought to do as I did to you." During the American Revolution, there's a little picture there, you know, one of our war that built our country, essentially. There was a story, and I think it's true, but we'll tell it as if it's true. There was a gentleman on a horse, and he was in civilian clothing, and he's riding along the road, and he comes by these soldiers, and they were fixing or repairing a defensive kind of barrier, right? So they're out there fixing the barrier, and he sees this other guy up on a horse in uniform, and he's barking out orders. Apparently, he was a leader, and he's yelling at the guys. So the guy on the horse, the civilian, he rides up to the guy and he says, So why are you yelling at these guys? Why are you doing this? And he says, "Because I'm a corporal." You know, he had the right. He was the leader of the battalion or the whatever you want to call them, right? The group of soldiers that was out there. So the guy apologizes on the horse. He gets off his horse and then he walks over and he begins to help the people to build the barricade and fix it. And when the repairs were finished, he says right here, "Mr. Corporal, next time you have a job like this and not enough men to do it, go to your commander in chief and I will come help you again." Notice the word in their "I," because as you probably guessed, it was George Washington. And it's no surprise. I mean, we've heard lots of stories about George Washington and his leadership. He's one of the most celebrated presidents in our country, one of the most celebrated leaders in our country as well, because he was a great leader. And it wasn't, you know, because he thought that he was more high than everybody else. It wasn't because he thought his needs were above other people's needs. It wasn't because he thought his safety was above other people's safety. But in fact, he felt he was level with everybody else. He wasn't above them. He was on the same plane. And that thought process is very evident in the story I just told you right here. And we think of George Washington and we think, none of us could ever be that kind of a leader. You know, he's like a one-of-a-kind guy. He was a guy who got our country going. None of us could ever attain to what George Washington accomplished. But I propose that actually we could attain to that. You and I, there's a very simple concept that I like to talk about tonight that we're all very capable of doing. All of us are capable of doing. That would make us just as great, if not greater, than who George Washington was and have a profound impact on those around us. So we need to influence others. In fact, I want to talk about the influence we have and the fact that we don't have a choice about influencing others. Some of us think, you know what? I'm not set out for this leadership thing. I'm not born to be a leader like George Washington. Like some people would say he was born to be a leader, right? I'm not born to be that way. And so anyways, you know, it's not for me. I'll just kind of ride low here, let other people kind of take the lead, and I'll do my thing. I'll be respectful. I'll follow their lead, and it'll be fine, right? So we think that, but actually, our influence, whether we like it or not, is given to other people. In fact, in Matthew chapter 5:14, it reads, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." And in Mark chapter 16, verses 15 and 16, it reads, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved, but he who disbelieves shall be condemned," right? Now notice both of these passages here, how they actually are actions that are called from us. They're not passive types of things for us to do, right? We can't just sit back and have these things happen. The things that we must go out and we must do. We must be lights to the world, and we must share the gospel. I want you to think about the people in your life that you have an influence over. Oh, by the way, going backwards here for a second, I'm skipping ahead. So how do these verses apply to us? Do they just apply to the elders and deacons? Do they apply to the apostles? Do they just apply to the pillars of the church or people who might know a lot about the Bible? Is that who it applies to? Of course not. It speaks to all of us, right? And you all know that. It speaks to all of us. And the reason why is because no matter what, our influence is going to be given to other people. It could be a good influence, but it also could be a bad influence. We are going to influence people one way or the other. So going back, think of some people in your lives that are influenced by your actions and by your choices. They might be spouses. They're very influenced by what you do, right? If you have kids, your children. Maybe family members. Hey, kids, how about your brothers and sisters? Do you think they're influenced by your decisions? Yeah. That's right, they are. Thank you. That was good. So, or even our brothers and sisters in Christ, especially, they're influenced by our decisions, aren't they? Even people we don't know that we come across every day, you know, we might just be standing in line next to somebody at the store, and based on what we do in that line, they watch us. We don't think that they're watching us, but they're watching us. They're watching our actions, and they're seeing what we're doing. They might see how we talk to the clerk when she might mess up on the checking or whatever it might be. Or, you know, how we allow people to go in line, or how we cut in front of those people. Whatever it is, all those little tiny things we do every day influence other people, don't they? Just think about it. So you don't have a choice. You are all leaders, for the good or bad. And that's what I want to get home here. Now, I'd like to look at three examples in the Bible here that I find really show the concept that I'd like to get across. If you could turn open to Ruth chapter 1. So go ahead and flip over there. I don't have the whole text up here. Ruth chapter 1. Now, most of us are familiar with the story of Naomi and Ruth. Naomi and her family, they had to move out of their homeland and go to the land of Moab. And that was because there was a famine in the land. And so that was a way for them to be able to support their family. So her husband and two sons moved over. And there was a lot of life-changing events that happened for Naomi in the land of Moab, right? Her husband passes away. I mean, what could be more life-changing than that? Each of her sons becomes married. And all of us who have gone to a wedding know that's a life-changing event. And then her two sons end up passing away. So there's a lot of sorrow, a lot of big things that have happened to Naomi. And so anyways, we know about her daughter-in-law. There was Orpah. I almost say Oprah every time. But there's Orpah and there's Ruth, right? And Orpah and Ruth are her daughter-in-laws that had married her sons. And they took her back to Judah. And then from there, she says, you know what? You go back to your land because I have nothing to offer to you. And she didn't have anything to offer. She was so old, you know, she said, I can't bear you a son. So you can marry him, right? Not going to support you that way. She didn't have any money that way to support her. She really had nothing for these ladies. And so Orpah, you know, takes her offer and goes back, right? And I think most people would. And there's nothing wrong with what Orpah did, was there? Because she couldn't be supported. But Ruth, and this is where we're going to start reading our passage here, does something different. Let's read Ruth chapter 1, verse 11 here. And it says, but Naomi said, return, my daughters. Should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. And I said, I have a hope. If I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. And here's one of the most beautiful pledges I think is in the entire Bible. Listen to these words. For where you go, I will go. Pretty normal there, right? For where you lodge, I will lodge. And your people shall be my people. And your God, my God. And here's the one that really hits me. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. Think about that for a second. She's making a life pledge, but it's not a life pledge for Naomi. Naomi, we can assume, is older, and so she's probably going to pass away first. We don't know for sure, right? But we can assume she's going to die first. And Ruth might have said, okay, until you die, I'm going to stay here. Then I'm going to go back to my people. But is that what she was saying here? No, this is not what she was saying here. What she was saying here is that she's going to stay her entire life too and be buried next to Naomi. This is a life sentence for both ladies. She's pledging that much commitment to her. And it says, moving on here, verse 18, when she saw that she was determined, when Naomi saw Ruth was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? And we'll go and stop there in that particular passage. I wanted to show you where I die, you will die. I just talked about that. Here in verse 19, there was a little part that I just caught my attention there. And it says, all the city was stirred because of them. All the city of Bethlehem was stirred because of them. Think about what that means, stirred. All the city. The word all really hits me there. And so I think, you know, in these days with the famine that had just taken place, there's got to be plenty of people that are passing away and dying, right? I would think that's a pretty normal thing. And so the fact that maybe Naomi and her sons had, or her husband and sons had passed away, I don't think that's out of the ordinary. So there must have been something special here about Ruth and Naomi that would have made the story kind of heightened above all the other stories that were tragic of the day. Wouldn't you think? And so, I mean, one of them probably is that her sons passed away and husband passed away and it's great sorrow. But I really think that it was a light that they were shining, especially Ruth was shining. They probably heard Ruth and about her dedication to Naomi and all the things she had done for her and what she had pledged. And I think that really struck them and it really caused them to be moved. So in Ruth, what was powerful about her story? I think that she was selfless and that she served. She served Naomi, right? She put aside all her personal needs for the needs of Naomi. And that struck a chord with the people of Bethlehem and with Naomi, and I'm sure with everybody she came in contact with. Moving on here, I want to go to Mark chapter 12 if you want to turn over there. This is often a story we hear about in the offering about the widow and her mite. And so let's read Mark chapter 12, verses 41 through 44. And it says, and he sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the people were putting money into the treasury. And many rich people were putting in large sums. A poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. Calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she owned, all that she had to live on. And so, if we look here, did she really put in more money? I mean, could we count here? It seems like the widow put much less in, right? They were putting in large sums of money. And look, the widow only put in a couple of gold or copper coins, right? But that's not the point. The point isn't how much she offered. We look here, and what we're talking about that's special about her is that she gave, down here at the bottom, she gave out of her poverty and she put all she owned, all she had to live on. She was giving away her food money. This is not just money to buy some fun toys or things like that, just some extra money she had like everybody else. And in fact, it was considered, look at this, for they all, she put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. Think of how much they offered. This isn't just one person we're comparing this lady to, this widow to. This is all the people that have contributed to the treasury. Every single one of them, hers counts for more. Why does hers count for more? Obviously, we know it's not the amount of money. Why does hers count for more? Because she gave selflessly everything she pretty much had for someone else. Again, I would say that she served. Moving on, I'd like to go to the greatest example, which you all know, would be Jesus. If you could turn over to John chapter 13, which was what we read at the start there. John chapter 13, please. Now, to give you some context of the passage here that we're about to read, this takes place just after the Lord's Supper was instituted. In fact, Jesus gets up from the table, as we're going to read, and does this particular thing, right? And at this event, we know as we talk about it, and we'll talk about it here at the end, there was a talk of his death and there was talk of betrayal. Think about how somber the mood must have been in this particular moment. The disciples, you know, they've been following Jesus all around, and all of a sudden he tells them about these things. Now, my favorite kind of movie I love to watch is the movies that are like, they have a message in them. They're like football movies where like somebody overcomes adversity as a team for some way, shape, or form. Anybody else like those movies out there? One of my favorite ones, non-football ones, is like McFarlane, USA. It's a cross-country movie running. But I love those movies. And in those movies, there's a common theme. It always happens every single time. It's my favorite part, too, even though I see it every single time, that there's a moment that comes up. It's an emotionally charged moment where it's very teachable. And the coach comes in, and he usually says something to the team or gives them some kind of a pep talk. Sometimes it's very spirited. It might be a yelling kind of pep talk. And sometimes it might be just a, you know, just kind of a humble, this is kind of where we need to go. But the coach chooses his words perfectly. I propose right here in the Bible, this is one of those moments right here. This is the moment in the game that Jesus gets up, and it's an emotionally charged moment. All the things that have happened. And this is the moment Jesus has to teach one of his most important lessons he ever teaches. Think about that. What does he choose to teach? Let's read about what he chose to teach at this moment. We're going to start back in verse 4. Sorry, let me get my Bible open there. Oh, she's up there. So John chapter 4, or sorry, 13, verse 4. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your help there. All right, so chapter 13, verse 4, it says, Jesus, I'll add his name here, got up from supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself. By the way, when I was looking up pictures of this on the internet, a lot of them had robes. I'm like, that's not right. He only had a towel, right? He set aside all his clothes and he girded himself with a towel. Then he poured water into the basin and began washing the disciples' feet and wiped them with the towel with which he was girded. So he came to Simon Peter. He said to him, Lord, do not wash my feet. Jesus answered and said to him, what I do, you do not realize now, but you will understand hereafter. Peter said to him, never shall you wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no part in me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. Now I'm thinking, Peter, you know, we always think, why did he do that? But I think all of us in that situation would have done the same thing, don't you think? Here's the Creator, here's God coming down, and he's asking us to wash his feet. I mean, how far much more above us is Jesus? And yet he's asking us to wash his feet. There could be nobody higher. And so I think that all of us might have done the same thing, really. We probably would have said, please, Lord, don't wash our feet. We'll wash your feet is probably what we would have said, right? You're the one that's deserving. But yet Jesus says, no, no, that's not what's going to happen. In fact, he even says, you don't have a part in me unless you allow me to do this. Let's keep reading here. I want to skip up to verse 12 there. And in verse 12, it reads, we'll read 12 to 15. There we go. 12 to 15, it says, so when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? So he's explaining the lesson. He gives an example. Gives a demonstration. Now he's going to teach the lesson. You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and teacher, wash your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you. So why did Jesus wash the apostles' feet? He wanted to give a powerful example, something that all of us could remember, these apostles could remember, everybody until the end of the world could remember that reads the Bible, of what he expects us to do. He gave an example of serving, right? It all comes down to really thinking of others more than ourselves. Now, I know tonight's sermon, it's really not one of those that's groundbreaking. You know, there's nothing new that any of you haven't heard before tonight, right? This is all old hat. Anybody who's heard sermons before. We've heard about serving. In fact, it's something that even people in the world know about, right? There's nothing new about the sermon. But really, just in my walk, and maybe you have a different idea about this, I think it's one of the most important or difficult parts of Christianity to have to serve other people. There's times where it's really easy, but there's times where it's really difficult too. And those are, of course, the times that matter. I mean, think of our human condition. We tend to be very selfish, right? We like to get what we want. I mean, look how we view the world. Right now, you're looking at this funny-looking guy up in front. I can't see what you're seeing through your eyes, but I can kind of picture it if I close my eyes, what you might be seeing. I don't want to do that. I'm just going to look at you guys. But, you know, you're all seeing something different right now. But you're seeing it from your own perspective. In fact, you're hearing the words that I speak from your perspective. You're feeling maybe the air conditioning or whatever it is around you from your perspective. But it's all from your point of view. So it's really difficult for humans to see other people's point of view because they don't have that viewpoint. You can't just go into their body and see what they see or feel what they feel or hear what they hear. That's impossible, isn't it? So we've got to constantly fight against that urge to be about us. I like to read Matthew chapter 20, verse 28. And really, I think what Christ was saying was this here. Matthew 20, verse 28. I'm going to turn over there. It says, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. So why did Jesus come? He came to serve, right? And to give his life in the ultimate act of sacrifice, the ultimate a show of servanthood, which was on the cross. You know, Christianity, it's really a relationship. It's not a religion, right? I mean, think of the greatest commandment. Matthew 22, verse 37 through 40, it says, and he said to him, honor the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. This is the great and foremost commandment, and the second is like it, and it talks about loving your neighbor as yourself, right? But those are relationships we're talking about. Christianity is a relationship with God, and it's a relationship with the people around you. It's all about relationships. If you don't have relationships, it isn't worth anything, especially the one with God. Think of how you could be a Christian without a relationship with God. Is that even possible? No, it's not. It's all about relationships, and the way we can strengthen those relationships and we can make them stronger and build them up is what Jesus taught us and what Ruth showed us and what the widow showed us as well. Those examples show us that we can build relationships in our lives through the serving of others. And in fact, let's read this whole passage from 25 through 28. We've already read 28. But it says, but Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, and their great men exercised authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Notice it says great among you. What does it mean to be great? I've always thought about that. You know, when I read this, what does Jesus mean? Does it mean we're supposed to become some superstar or some popular person? Or I don't know. You know what I think great means here? I think it means that you have influence over other people, that you're winning souls, that you're saving their souls, that you're helping them out. I think that's what it means to be great in the kingdom of God, is that you're building those relationships with God and with people. You know, I believe the problem in this world right now, and I think we can trace most every problem back to this word, is selfishness. I mean, think about it. Any problem you have, you can probably say, yep, somebody was trying to get their way somehow, some way, some shape or form, right? But if we have selflessness, it'll knock it out of the way there, it can help us build and win, right? What do we win? We win great marriages when we serve, right? We win strong families. Who doesn't want a strong family? Everybody does. We can win lifelong friendships. And I really highlighted this one because when we serve others, it gives us the ability and the power to do the most important thing that we're here on this earth to do, and that's to win souls, is to save souls, There's so many people out there that need us. Their souls are suffering. And sometimes, you know, we'll look down upon them, but everybody's got a soul that God cares about. Until the day they die, until their last dying moment, God is hoping that they will return. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 6 and 7, I think it is, it talks about that God is not slow about his promises, but is patient towards us, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance, right? He's slow, he's waiting, because he wants everybody to get there. I want to leave you with a lasting thought here. Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 through 15, it says, do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear to lights of the world. You know, we're always looking, how do we fix the problems in this world? I don't think we can, right? But how do we influence or affect the problems in this world? It's really simple. Look at George Washington. You know how he became famous? He knew the secret right here. And by the way, George Washington was a Bible reader, so I'm sure that he read this lesson, and I'm sure he carried it into his leadership actions. But he served others. And so in a world of self and doing what we want and getting what we want, we constantly fight the battle, but we need to, in light of this, serve other people. So at this time, if you'd like to come forward, if you need the prayers of the congregation for some kind of need you might have, if you'd like to be baptized and become a Christian so you can be covered by the blood of Christ and be renewed, you can come forward at this time as we stand and sing the song of invitation.